Our first reporter this morning is John McVane, who speaks from London.
This is London. London heard today that Japanese bombs have for the first time fallen on Australian soil. The Prime Minister of Australia, Mr. Curtin, announced that Darwin in North Australia had been raided and that a number of bombs had been dropped, although the extent of the raid wasn't known. Later, it was officially stated that there had been some casualties and damage to service installations. The raid is reported to have lasted about an hour, with the attack concentrated on the town of Darwin and shipping in the harbor. Darwin is the chief town of northern Australia, with a deep water harbor and airport. There's no new development in the British internal situation today, except the announcement of a two-day parliamentary debate on the war next week. There have been a lot of meetings of various parliamentary groups, and cabinet members have been in consultation. It's understood that some members of parliament have informed the Prime Minister that feeling in their constituencies is serious. Members who tested this feeling were surprised to find strong emphasis on the need for reorganization of the government and more criticism of Mr. Churchill himself than they'd expected. The most likely opinion among members of parliament, based on very scanty information, is that Mr. Churchill will consent to the idea of a streamlined war cabinet to direct the war effort, but that he himself will continue holding his job as defense minister. Sir Stafford Cripps and Lloyd George are still said to be likely war cabinet choices. British official quarters today deny reports that the sending of mining machinery to the Rio Tinto copper and pyrites mines in Spain is a sign that the British are adopting a policy of appeasement toward General Franco's government. It's explained here that the Rio Tinto mines are British owned, that 70-odd percent of the output goes to the United States, that the British take what they want of the remainder, and what's left goes to Spain for internal consumption. It's said that unless machinery is sent to the mines from time to time from the United States or Britain, the mines would have to close down, and the Allies would lose a valuable supply of metal. Spain has been looming somewhat larger in British speculation these last few days. There have been reports that Marshal Petain's chief of cabinet went to Spain with Madame Petain to try to develop Petain's pet plan for a Latin bloc between Spain, Portugal, France, and Italy. Some reports say that the question of Spain's taking over French Morocco was also raised. The opening of the Riom trials of France's former premiers and General Gamelin has also focused British interest on Vichy. The British are watching Vichy's attempts to explain away Vichy aid to General Rommel. The London Times today asserts that since details of the assistance were revealed, Vichy hasn't quite known what to say, whether to suggest that it was playing rather a deep game by sending supplies in order to appease the Germans and keep them from invading North Africa, or whether to say that no supplies at all were sent. Admiral d'Arlon took the first line and Monsieur Debrino, Vichy ambassador in Paris, the second. Debrino said that the capacity of the Tunisian railroad was so small that only part of the supplies sent across the Mediterranean could be delivered. It's been emphasized here that the deliveries were made by trucks or by small boats from Bizerta to Tripoli. The Times says that with Vichy connivance, the Italians are freely using French ships or Italian ships under French colors to get stuff across the Mediterranean to Rommel. As seen from London, Ambassador Henriet's explanations to Washington that Vichy has no intention of accepting Japanese protection for Madagascar, the strategic island off the South African coast, would have seemed more real if Vichy hadn't so readily accepted Japanese protection for Indochina. The fact that Vichy did that opened the way to Malaya for the Japanese. If Vichy does the same thing with Madagascar, the way will be open for an attack on South Africa and on the only open supply link with the Middle East. British commentators are rather bitterly amused at the Vichy attempt to pin the loss of the war on Daladier, Blum, and Gamelin by the trial at Rio. It's pointed out here that Petain has personally condemned them before the trial began, and the French newspaper published in London asks, what hero would risk the concentration camp for not recognizing the guilt affirmed by the chief? The Yorkshire Post says Monsieur Blum and the rest are being tried not because they failed France, but because they stood for resistance to Hitler. The Führer always seeks to punish those who have dared oppose him, and it's his method always to destroy a nation's faith in itself by discrediting every man of spirit among its leaders. This the Vichy government is helping him accomplish in France. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, back here in New York, we have a report from Moscow. The Russians announced that Soviet troops have made further advances on the central and southern sectors. The Soviet Information Bureau says, however, that Red soldiers had to beat off several fierce German attacks before they recaptured two villages on the Central Front. The Nazis left 200 dead on that battlefield. Another action on the Central Front saw the Russians take several German dugouts and trenches. 150 enemy officers and men are said by the communique to have been killed and three field pieces destroyed. The Communist Party newspaper Pravda tells of a Red Army advance in the south. 7 of 14 counterattacking German tanks are claimed damaged or destroyed, and 2 battalions of supporting automatic riflemen dispersed and annihilated. On the spot news from the Pacific Front comes to us now through our newsroom in San Francisco.
Covering the news from the Netherlands East Indies in the far Pacific is Sidney Albright, speaking from Batavia, Java.
This is Sidney Albright speaking in Batavia. The time is 7:36 on Thursday evening. In an interview today with Mr. L.W. Elliott, head of the Standard Oil refineries at Palembang, Sumatra, I was told the amazing story of one of the world's largest fires, the voluntary destruction by the military authorities of the properties under his care to prevent them from falling into enemy hands. On Friday the 13th, Japanese conducted extensive reconnaissance over the refineries and machine gun employees. This was taken as a sign that the assault was not far off. The next morning at 9:15, swarms of planes arrived. There were three groups of from 40 to 60 each. As Elliot said, they looked like V's of ducks. They dropped to about 1,000 feet, directly over the refineries at Sungi Gerong and Tacho, when the parachutists bailed out. The planes came from the direction of Singapore. Meanwhile, another group of transport planes with fighter escorts arrived from the opposite direction and also dropped parachutists. The refinery had conducted air raid precaution drills for many months, so every man was at his post, ready for the emergency. The parachutists were immediately engaged, but they spread out and remained in the swamp and jungle in back of the property. The Sungi Gerong plant is virtually an island. Two sides facing water, the other sides are protected by swamps, with thick jungle in the background. Dutch armed forces cleaned out the stray parachutists and forced the others to remain in more or less of a concealed position. The Dutch and native troops did excellent work. Without their strong defense, the army engineers could not have succeeded in carrying out the destruction program. Mr. Elliott was emphatic on this point. He also stated that there were no signs whatsoever of any fifth column activity. In fact, the entire population rose up as one to annihilate the invaders. By noon on Saturday, the task of evacuating was started. All unnecessary employees were taken across the river to Palembang. Altogether, there were approximately 400 Europeans and 3,300 natives. These figures include 70 American men whose wives had returned to the States months before. This evacuation in itself was a remarkable feat. There was not one single casualty, despite the constant pressure of enemy aircraft. Later in the afternoon, 9 more Japanese bombers flew over with parachutist reinforcements. 2 were shot down by anti-aircraft guns. Sunday morning, before daylight, the grim job of destruction was started, and before the day was over, one of the world's most valuable oil properties was totally destroyed. So was the life's work of Mr. Elliott, who was responsible for building the entire plant from the time the first piece of machinery was set up. Whole refinery stocks, consisting of millions of barrels of crude oil, aviation gasoline, and other petroleum products, were set ablaze by electrical apparatus and bombs. The roar could be heard miles away, but there was no explosion. This had to be avoided to prevent injuring the engineers who were still at their task. Also, to keep the flaming oil off the rivers so as not to hinder the evacuation. At Tendopo, 80 miles inland, are the oil wells, numbering several hundred in all. This point is connected with the refineries by pipelines. On Sunday and Monday, the work of destroying this property was completed. The wells were blocked and dynamited, but the real job was to destroy the pipeline. Crews working at various points along the 80-mile stretch blasted the pipe to bits every few hundred feet.
That was Sidney Albright in Batavia, Java. News here in the United States is reported for us by Earl Godwin in the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. If you ever saw a kid caught stealing the jam and being made to put it back under protestations of he didn't know he shouldn't take it, you'll realize what your red-faced, shame-faced Congress is looking like this morning. Because the Senate's going to start putting back the jam sometime today by a righteous, breast-slapping drive to repeal that little-understood so-called congressional pension paragraph. And on the House side yesterday, I saw a petition signed by 134 members of that body asking for immediate consideration of this jam-stealing law, that is, the jam-stealing repeal, if you want to look at it in that inconsiderate way. No doubt little is understood about this matter, because all this hullabaloo started when a chap I know named Harry Brown of the Spokesman Review of Spokane sent to his paper from Washington a piece saying that Senators Bone and Walgren of Washington had voted themselves a pension of $4,127 a year. That turned out to be mathematically incorrect by nearly 1,000%. But at the same time, nobody I know has ever fully comprehended the complex actuarial double-barrel system, which wouldn't give the average senator anything but around $400 or $500 a year with ordinary contributions from now on. But it wouldn't start for about 10 years. But be that as it may, congressional pensions are a dead duck now, and the American people will never feel this repeal in their taxes and would never have felt it in their taxes had it been retained. Meantime, the lithe and fascinating Jim Landis, Harvard Law School dean brought here to head civil defense at full time, sweeps out the doubtful activities from civil defense, and with it goes Myra Chanis, the dancer, with a low bow and no bouquet, and half a dozen ex-politicians who are drawing a great many, many more times more pay than all the senators from the east half of the U.S. would start to draw for 10 years more. Among those dropping from the payroll because Landis wants a streamlined organization on civil defense are former Mayor Walmsley of New Orleans at $22.22 a day, former socialist, longtime Mayor Hone of Milwaukee, Joe Schultz of Louisville, and Murray Stand of New York. And Congress, with the full knowledge that the country is 10 jumps ahead of Washington, writes into an appropriation bill an added $300,000 with directions to the FBI and the Department of Justice to get going after the Japs and Fifth Columns on the West Coast. Congressmen are restive. They applauded John Rankin of Mississippi, who said, "Once a Jap, always a Jap, and please start putting all Japs out of harm's way." The realistic Rankin doesn't think much of the legalistic view that when a Jap becomes a U.S. citizen, he's beyond reproach. Another congressman, Wright Patman from Texas, calls attention to what might have happened had the House changed one vote to no on fateful August 12, 1941, when they passed the bill to extend selective service training beyond the original year. That vote, 203 to 202, kept the troops in the West and added to the safety. Suppose, asked Patman, we had stopped training and reduced the army, we would have seen the Japs coming to Seattle or Frisco instead of Pearl Harbor. The Senate and the House seem certain to join forces in investigating the Normandy fire. A joint congressional fact-finding board is expected to determine whether the big former French liner was the victim of negligence or sabotage or what. And that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. And that report from our Capitol ends this morning's World Roundup of News. Speakers were John McVane from London, Sidney Albright from Batavia, and Earl Godwin from Washington. For the latest news, it's a pretty good idea to keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.